Jason Gotz here. You're listening to Clever Creature. It's an experimental variety show, and for me, it's a creative leap of faith. Each episode starts with one random word. I record an audio diary entry. I write and produce a story and a song about the word. Then I sit down with a guest to talk about the word and about taking creative risks. And there's a bonus track, a short guided meditation at the end of each episode. You can listen straight through, or you can bounce all over the place. It's totally up to you. The past week or so has seen global mourning and a massive outpouring of positive action after the murder of George Floyd. If you're looking for specific ways to help fight racial injustice, I would suggest following the Black Lives Matter hashtag on Twitter or Instagram, or going to blacklivesmatter.com or to naacp.org. The world needs to change faster than it knows how to change, and it needs your help. I'll share one listener comment each week on the show, and so please take a minute to rate and review Clever Creature on Himalaya, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever podcast app you're listening on. It really helps people discover the show. This one is from iTunes, from someone calling themselves This Mortal Toil, and the title is Laura Veers? Hi, Jason. I've been a longtime listener of The Big Think. This Mortal Coil is referring to Think Again, my former podcast, and am thrilled to subscribe to Clever Creature. Thank you for taking the leap and being so brave. Do you know the singer-songwriter Laura Veers? She has a really interesting set of creativity cards for songwriting, fiction, and poetry. Would be dreamy to hear the two of you wax poetic about creativity. There are many great things I don't know about, and Laura Veers is apparently one of them. I will look into her right away, and this sounds amazing. So quite possibly if she's willing to come on a future show. Clever Creature is dedicated to my sister, Mary Hamilton, who was so much braver than I am. Extra special thanks to my son, Emre Gotz, who composed and plays the theme music. Let's get going. Season 1 is 8 episodes, May to August 2020. This is episode 3. Rally. So, it is Tuesday, the 25th of February, when I'm recording this. And this is the third day I'm sitting down to generate a random word and make a story and a song out of it. When I was younger, and just starting to write poems and later on writing songs, there was this belief. I mean, this is common. This, you know, I didn't invent this. This happens to a lot of people who make things. But there was this idea of the muse. There was this sense that the inspiration came when it came, and the inspiration was holy, and you should wait for it to come because that's how you got the purest and the best and the most beautiful art. Whatever came to you when it came was a gift, as it were, from the gods. And to force it in some way was a kind of violence and was going to result in something untrue somehow. I can't say that I totally don't feel that way anymore, in the following sense that when something comes, a poem or a song or whatever it is, like even if I've actually set up a time to sit down and make that thing, there is still something glorious and extraordinary and kind of magical, spiritual about that, you know? It's like, oh my God, where did that come from? There's something in that that matters to me. And I know that there are working artists of all kinds who think in more of a craft way and say, stop being so precious about it. I don't know if they would be that harsh, but like not to treat it in that kind of mystical, magical way, because the idea is that things get better through revision, they get better through being subjected to scrutiny in a collaborative way with other people. And so that kind of mysticism or preciousness is actually harmful to the job of creating good art. But for me anyway, there's no way I wouldn't want to do this if there wasn't magic in it. Aeneas Mitchell, in one of our conversations, in our only conversation on Think Again, was talking about how melody comes up from the ground. It's like tapping into something primal and essential. And I mean, that feeling of tapping into something that you don't know where it comes from and that's speaking and moving through you, like that is, as far as I feel it, the only reason to do this kind of thing. That said, If you sit and you wait for the muse to come, you can be waiting a very long time. And in the past, I started writing songs when I was 18. And, I ended up writing maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 songs a year, sometimes none, sometimes one or two. And that was fine and everything. But then most of my life, most of my year was spent not writing songs and not singing. And the guitar would get very little love for a long time. It would just kind of sit there in a corner gathering dust. So, I think there is a balance to be struck. It's sort of what people think of as discipline. And I think this thing, Clever Creature, this game that I'm playing is something like that. It's a structure and a discipline where I know that every Tuesday for a certain period of time, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to make something. And whatever that thing is, that's what it is. And then, I can go back and I can revise it, but there is that commitment to sit down and do it. And what inevitably happens once you do that, at least for me, when you've set up a discipline like that and a commitment, it's like on the one hand, it's really good because you know that that's what you're going to do. And the thing that you want to do, which is writing and expressing yourself in those ways, is going to happen. It also introduces a certain amount of pressure, which is both good and not good. Like, what if you don't sleep the night before? What if, as is happening in my life right now, your son is having extreme issues of anxiety around school. And so the morning is a total challenge, to put it lightly. Still, come 9:30, 10 o'clock, you turn on the microphone and you talk. And then you pick your random word and then you write. And so, how do you manage that? What does it mean to find the space within that structure to discover the things that make this worth doing? And I think it's good. I mean, I think you can always tweak the structures. You can always change what day you do something. It's not like once you've set a discipline, you can never, ever, ever think about it again. But some kind of structure is good because when you're, I don't want to say forced, but when it's just the thing that is done at a certain time, you actually paradoxically perhaps end up realizing that you're a lot more capable of just being in that place rather than sitting around and waiting for it to happen than you might otherwise think. And you can make more work, and as a result, your work may progress faster, or you can go to different places that you would never get to if you just sat around waiting for half a year. So here we are in week three. And they always say that the sophomore album is the toughest one. We had our sophomore album last week. So I don't know what they called the third one, the junior album. But let's go to the random word generator and see what the word is going to be. So the word for this episode is rally. Rally, RALLY. It's 5:30 in the morning. As far as the eye can see, the streets are filled with garbage. The feral pigs are rooting through it in packs, fighting over a gristly pork chop bone here, a Ziploc bag full of a squashed peanut butter and jelly sandwich there. My energy's up. I've trained for this. My limbs are lithe and slick, waxed and frictionless. Resting heart rate, 50 BPM, strong and steady. And I've got to admit, I'm looking fine too, in my brick red microfiber bodysuit. Bold but earthy, vivid yet grounded. My strategy is this: clear the field, then claim victory before Marfa Quinones knows what's hit her. She won't get the best of me again. After rigorous testing, I've devised a formula so pheromonally pungent and concentrated that the feral pigs will make a porcine beeline straight down Canyon Avenue to the top of the cliffs, where I'll be waiting. A sonic blast at just the right frequency will scramble their nervous systems, sending them into a panic and over the edge to their collective doom. Not all of them, maybe, but enough to give me the opening I need. Ruthless?
please. There's not a soul in this city that hasn't fantasized about a feral pig holocaust, and that includes you. How many toddlers a year need to be gored before people do the math and realize it's us or them? The government's thrown up its hands. No farm will take them. Meanwhile, the garbage just keeps piling up. The humidity hangs on to the stench and spreads disease. My mom won't leave her apartment, and now the garbage is piling up indoors, too. Any day now, she's going to trip over it and break something. At least it's my garbage, she says. There's the siren. The rally has begun. I run along Canyon, trailing Pied Piper 12, that's what I call it because it took 12 tries to get it right, behind me as I go. The trickle pack is working its magic. The pigs are catching on already. Behind me, a pack is gathering, gaining speed. I hear the rhythmic stampede of their trotters on the poorly maintained macadam. There's a tree at the edge of the cliff. I've got a good 50 yards on the lead pig and I'm fast, so I'll outstrip them all no problem. Just a little further, just a little further. There, I'm up. Toward the cliffs, Canyon Avenue dissolves into dirt and there's a rising cloud of dust obscuring the city as the pigs race toward their fate. 10 or 20 scrunched up, determined pig faces draw the cloud onward like a many-headed avatar of all dust storms ever. You gotta admire their focus, but I'm focused too. And unlike the pigs, I have a higher brain. I know exactly what I'm doing. I ditch the empty trickle pack over the cliff. At the base of the tree, a tide pool, then a great lake of feral pigs gathers. They're fired up, anxious and anticipatory, like a bunch of cultists awaiting the coming of their messiah. Little do they know that's me, and I am a vengeful god. I've got to act fast. By now, Quinones will have at least 2 of the 55 city blocks clear. Drawing the pigs off has given her a head start, but no matter. There was no way around it. I've got a good plan. I've got to have faith in it. For Mom's sake, Quinones will not win. Critical porcine density is reached. I trigger the blast, and it works like a charm. Like teenagers at a concert, the pigs rush blindly forward, wave after wave of them tumbling over the edge. In 4 minutes, 36 seconds, it's done. Only a few befuddled stragglers remain. Nothing to worry about, really. In my microfiber suit, glistening iridescently for the hidden cameras, channeling the hopes and dreams of a downtrodden people into an inspiring streak on their TV sets as they watch the rally live, chewing on some stale pretzels or fruit leather or whatever they managed to hoard the last time the dormant pig alert sounded, I put phase 2 of my plan into action. Quinones and the other competitors will be doing what they've always done, moving block to block in predetermined patterns, trailed by some creaking, improvised disposal caravan. Some are better engineers than others. Some of their machines more efficient, but these are incremental improvements on an old, broken formula. You know the story of the Gordian Knot? Never impressed me much. A sophisticated puzzle obliterated by a thug. Instead of untying the knot, Alexander just hacks it in half. Is this thinking outside of the box? No, it's brutalism. I may be a pig killer, but a worthy puzzle deserves respect. It deserves a worthy solution. After all, what is all this garbage anyway? It's our collective desire to forget come back to haunt us. When the system's working efficiently, it just gets taken somewhere else to be buried or burned or sent out to sea. Recycling, upcycling. Every solution we've tried has forced us to cut corners, eliminating actual garbage while allowing the metaphorical crap to pile up elsewhere. What we need is symbiosis. Rebalancing. From the 4 cardinal directions, the shimmering blobs ooze into the streets. Some are as high as the buildings, some roughly the size of a compact car. They break off and rejoin one another, little Atmans leaving and returning to Brahman in an endless cycle. It's one thing, this thing, a single heightened consciousness, too refined to risk dilution with the brains of wild beasts, so the pigs had to go first. This deal is a good one. What's the loss of my 12 competitors who, swift as they might be, will have nowhere to run? What are 12 absorptions without consent in exchange for our almost total freedom? The blob will live among us. It will feed off our garbage. It is benevolent. Its mind is beautiful, in fact. And as far as I know, I alone have been invited into its geometric and dazzlingly intricate dreams. And these dreams will become the dreams of our city. Soon all of us will have access and the freedom to choose whether to go back to our hardscrabble finite lives or to merge with it willingly, becoming part of something larger and better than ourselves. But these are decisions for tomorrow. Now, I have to meet the press, claim my victory, and liberate the people. Go take Mom out for a nice fancy dinner. Clam's Casino, her favorite. They're an appetizer, but I think we'll get 3 orders. Hell, even 4 maybe, and just make them the whole meal. A longish time ago, in a very different city, there was something I was thinking. I've got bits and pieces stuck inside my brain. Can't quite reassemble them. A young woman on a mission in a TV competition, and the timing was essential, and the stakes were existential. Did we win? Who was we again? I'm calling out to you. The words are so specific, though. I doubt you've got the key, but if you do, could you please, please give it back to me? Give it back to me. A garden full of spiders and a spider for each pomegranate tree. Inside its web of gold. And beneath one we just sit and we make plans for further sitting. And the city in the egg sack, it is dreaming of a rally. And I see just how the end must go. My guest today is Shima Oliai. She was the co-producer of the brilliant podcast series Dolly Parton's America, along with Radiolab's Jad Abumrad. Shima is a consulting producer for Radiolab, and she co-produced the miniseries Unerased, A History of Conversion Therapy in America, which KQED News called the best podcast of 2018.
So the random word of this episode that the algorithmic gods gave to me was rally. When I saw that word on my screen, my heart sank. I have no relationship whatsoever to this word.
Oh my God.
I could think of about 17 things that it means, none of which particularly interests me, but I still had to write a story and a song. And so now I give it to you to take a second and find a way in.
Yeah. I've been thinking a lot about the right to assemble, freedom of assembly, and when I first heard rally, I thought about what I would really like people to be doing in this country right now is to be organizing and to be rallying together to kind of dismantle some of the things that have come to the surface via the current situation.
Like the income inequality we were talking about.
I'm a lover of Jean Sharp's work, who was all about nonviolent tactics and using kind of jujitsu, people power, to gain political freedom. So much of a part of that is allowing people to get together, to be connected. And right now we live in a time where people cannot rally in that way physically.
Right.
It's more in this internet realm or via phone. Though actually, I think some of the rallying has been deeper because of that, at least for me.
I don't know if it's a generational thing or a temperamental thing or what. I find the virtual rallying points a little hard to plug into. I mean, I not that I don't understand how to use Zoom, but the sense of connection, like it feels like mercury, like I slip off of it. But it sounds like for you, you've actually found connection
there. Well, maybe I've just disproved myself, because I think the deepest connections I've made is have been one-to-one and not really in a rally or like a large group of people kind of form. I think this is also why people kind of hate on protests, because as much as you gather all these people together, without the end goal being achieved, it's very difficult to sustain a rally or sustain that kind of movement, or such as an Occupy movement. But I will say the one-on-one has helped me rally myself. Like every day I've encountered one person who's kind of on the verge of breakdown or just acknowledging something has been taken out from under them. And the first thing I have to kind of plug into is my own spirit to rally. It's kind of the most important characteristic right now for me in my daily life. No matter what's coming at me, I feel like I'm Molly Brown on the Titanic, where I want to be screaming out at everyone and I want to say, hey, because I'm here, this ship can't go down. And there's some part of me that's getting very deeply rooted in, I'm a tree or I'm a pillar. And you cannot knock me down.
You mentioned that immediately after talking about people you were meeting who are kind of at the breaking point. Do you find that that need in other people is helpful in activating that rallying spirit for you?
Being connected one-on-one, so you actually know what's going on in someone's life. It's a more intimate space of dialogue. I think it helps you rally because it's not surface level. It's right. Like really connecting to the other human. I think encouraging others always helps you rally, right? You listen to what you're saying and you hear your own advice. So that's the beauty of encouraging others is
right.
You kind of get it through telling someone else. I had a friend, a coworker, she's going through a thing in her relationship with someone online. It was actually right at the start of the quarantine. And she was calling me about this guy she'd been dating and what he was doing. And then I shared this story about someone I know named Michiko. Her biggest victory story in her life was her love story. She had this crazy experience where her husband was cheating on her with someone he worked with, and then she found out. She wasn't an angry person, so she just felt dead inside and she felt numb and she lost all this weight. And part of her rallying was to get angry, was to actually access her anger. Once she was open, she was able to be angry. I actually talked to her yesterday. She's in Japan right now. And she said, Shima, I actually prayed for him to die. She's like, I realized later that was wrong, you know, but she was in so much pain, right?
That's really interesting, because I think that it gets for me exactly at the ambivalence that I feel toward the word rally, right? Because it is both the sense of coming back from loss or trouble. And then there is the sort of communal, the group sense, right? And when I think about that group anger and that group emotion, whether it's the sense of anger against something or whether it's the sense of collective triumph, it frightens me because it can so easily segue into a kind of strange animalistic, tribalistic group ego trip, which can go in all kinds of directions. So I think of like the Nuremberg rallies, you know, or Trump's rallies, how anger is such a seesaw in that way. But sometimes a necessary lever, as you say.
Well, also, you know, sociologists and in group psychology, they study this, and the idea of character that's functioning on an animalistic level easily unites. And people that are just trying to live their life and be left alone because they just want to live a good life, they don't easily rally with others. So I think the first thing that Michiko had was her kind of surrogate mother figure, the woman that had kind of raised her but was not her actual mom, had pushed her to share about what was going on, which Michiko was ashamed to share. She was a leader. Everyone knew the couple. She was very afraid to share this thing that she felt was such a failure. But that woman in her life pushed her to do so. And then the anger came out. It's an adorable image of this young woman who everyone thought was an angel, who never hurt anyone. She, to this day, is like the best big sister I ever had. And she was like a legend in LA, LA Buddhist girl. To see her angry was so strange, but also kind of awe-inspiring. Her young women friends were angry on behalf of her, but for her to access it was a process and a journey to just feel.
These are thought experiments, right? She didn't actually murder anybody,
no,
right? She sat there wishing, visualizing,
yeah,
and using the anger in that way, which ultimately then became an empowering tool.
It was a point of letting it all go. It was a point of power. It's my life. I am the protagonist of my life. I'm going to fast forward the ending of the story, but she and Juan got back together.
Oh, wow. After this whole
After all process. Of this, after all wow. the women in Michiko's life hated on Juan, they get back together. They have two beautiful children. They move to Japan. They're so happy. And so wow. going full circle, my coworker, when she called me, I was sharing the story with her about her current love situation and that she was really in pain about it. And I shared this story. She said, so wait, how did that happen? And how does this? And my gut feeling was, in the same way that the combustion happened, Michiko also left. Michiko also kept going. Michiko also kept growing. She also kept reforming the tenets of her heart. Juan might never have changed, but in his element, he was transforming something too. So both right. when they came back together, she was not someone you could walk on. And he was someone who was much more self-aware. And it was, that was the bridge for the new marriage and for their happiness. So this was my full circle moment about the rally was I was trying to rally my coworker and her broken heart. And I shared the story about Michiko. And then yesterday I talked to Michiko, who rallied me about her life and how it's turned out and how she still has challenges, but she keeps seeing that her life somehow reemerges and she's able to forge the best pathway. But going back to my coworker, when I shared the story with her, she knew what I was going through in my own life. And she goes, wow, Shima, maybe you should listen to your own advice. And I think the part of it was Michiko also had the guts to leave. And Dolly, too, in the Dolly Parton's America series says, you know, God was telling me to go. God was telling me it was time to go.
This is when she's gearing herself up to leave the work relationship and possibly more than that, we don't know, with Porter Wagner, who had been sort of her mentor and partner.
Yeah, her duet partner and the guy who gave her her first really, really big break. So anyway, it was really encouraging. So like usually when you encourage others or you have to rally yourself sometimes, but rallying others really helps along the way. Rallying yourself is the greatest force you'll ever give yourself.
For me anyway, it's one of the hardest things. It's been one of the like longest lessons that I've had to learn, like to recognize when the inner voices are either not helping me rally or doing the exact opposite. You know, and how to find the voices that actually energize and feed you.
You know, 10 years ago, I went to a world peace training course where I met all these people from around the world. And I wrote this down in my journal. It was exactly 10 years ago in like 5 days. And so I was going through my old journal and I wrote down, faith is courage. Courage is justice. And that kind of goes back to the bigger idea of a rally. Like when I really feel like there's no injustice in the world and my heart is crying out for justice, which I feel right now going through this pandemic, I have to remember the faith, like faith first. That's the rallying spirit of hope.
Right.
Faith first, right. And then the courage comes. And then with the courage, you can make justice happen. Without the faith in very dire circumstances, it's very difficult.
I came from a very kind of rationalist background, you know, so I think for people in that situation or who don't come from any obvious kind of faith, the question becomes where to find that faith, where to get it in the first place. And I don't know, maybe we can use that as a transition into the second part where I want to talk about taking risks, taking creative risks in our lives, in your life, in your career, times when maybe even the faith wasn't there at the moment, or maybe you weren't entirely sure, but you did have a sense that you needed to push beyond a certain boundary, stretch out some tendril in some creative direction, and where the act of doing that then can feed the faith because of what you get back.
So what I have found in my own life is I take whatever's in front of me and run with it as hard as I can. And so that's kind of the first creative risk, is not to question what's in front of me, is to just grab it and do my best with it. And so,
and why do you do that? Why are you, why were you taught to do that? Or is that just,
yeah,
why?
I think that was the people that I knew that were happiest in their old age, when they shared about their young life, the people that had the most interesting lives, it wasn't like A to B, a straight line up, you know, ascending. It was this like valley, and there's like 10,000 points, and it goes up and down and over here and, you know, all around. Those people had the most amazing lives to me. But I'm not built like that. I'm a nerdy girl. Like, I love reading. Mm-hmm. So I was terrified of that kind of life, but that's what I wanted. So I would say my creative risks did not come intentionally. My creative risks were, I didn't start in a place of privilege. Like, I became financially independent at 17, but that was because, okay, I was going to school. I was on a scholarship, and then I didn't know how to use money, and I probably wasted a lot of it. And then I got out of school. I worked in a recording studio, but I also got in a horrible car accident right before that. And then, so I was serving smoothies because I couldn't even make it to the recording studio. So I had to put that on hold. Then I was a waitress. So I had to do all of these jobs that were not what you would consider creative. Like,
right,
the smoothie order had a recipe sheet. Like, I couldn't go off of the, you know, what was on the page. And I had to wear khaki Dockers. Like, I just, and a red visor. It was not my most creative artistic Lady Gaga moment or Shima Gaga moment. It was like, I was so far from my future self, but I had no choice. I had no choice but to creatively risk that I was going to be okay by just doing the thing in front of me the best I could. And now those, right, moments where I felt like I was the most hopeless person on the planet, they're the most cherishing times in my life.
When I talk to you now, and like that, just your energy, the way it is, like, I imagine you at 20 years old working in a smoothie place. I want to assume that you would be super impatient, wanting to move the hell on, get something going. Like, those two energies seem almost in conflict. I mean, you had to make a living, basically.
Yeah, I think that's the benefit of just being forced to face life on your own and without, right, a cushion. Because then you start talking to your coworkers, and then you hear other stories, and then all of a sudden you're volunteering with a group called Food Not Bombs, you know, and serving meals to the homeless, right, every week. And then, you know, you start biking around everywhere, and you become parts of different kinds of culture that you would have never become a part of if you just always stayed in your safe realm.
Yeah, because all of those invisible opportunities for creative risk and growth are hidden within the fairly boring context of the coffee bar or whatever, in the form of all those other people that are there.
A big part of my creative risks that I wouldn't necessarily, it's hard to call them creative risks, but were the friendships I formed with people from all walks of life, because my journey was so jagged and here and there. And then I was a second grade teacher, and then I was working at a nonprofit, and then I was getting my master's, and then I was jobless again, and then I was working in TV. I think I was just trying to find my way, but the friendships I formed, the creative risk to connect to people that you wouldn't have otherwise connected with, and when you, sure, have a moment with them to really be honest about what you're going through, that has taken my life so far.
Deep friendship is always a creative risk. Just being vulnerable to another person. I mean, to kind of circle back to something we said before, one thing that I've observed in a couple of the very long-term friendships that I've had was that there's often this kind of turning of the tables where I'm thinking back to one very close friend I have who, like, when he met me, just because of my own self-esteem or whatever, he reached out to me, and I was somewhat intimidated because I thought he was more interesting and cool. And so for a long time, the relationship had this dynamic where I was kind of like looking up to him. And then over time, yes, at different times, that has completely reversed, where I've ended up being in a mentor position to him,
yes,
and, you know, and back and forth. And like, that's, I think, one of the biggest benefits of taking that kind of risk of staying in connection.
There's a metaphor about this, about heaven and hell. At a banquet in hell, everyone is surrounded by the most lavish food, and their chopsticks are 10 feet long, so they can't feed themselves. So everyone is starving in front of the most lavish meal they've ever seen. heaven is the exact same scene, but everyone's feeding someone else. What I've noticed is, for instance, I was working on a TV show, and one morning, someone who was only working there for a week, so it wasn't someone that could get me ahead in my job, like I couldn't get anything from them. And I think the fourth day he was there, substituting for, I think, a script coordinator, he opened up to me about something he was suffering with. Or he had asked me a question. I would say it was more surface level. And then I opened up and I shared about something I'd gone through. And then he opened up. And I only met him that week, but that was the beginning of our friendship. And we connected outside of work after that. He, to this day, is one of my closest friends. And actually, during this quarantine, he's been such a bright light. And I felt the same way. Like, I gave life to him at a hard time. Do you know how many things he went through in the comedy TV world? And I would just say, get smart. Like, don't get angry. Get smart. Like, and just hold on. Hold on. Don't let them do that to you. Like, and now, when I have troubles, he knows how to encourage me too. So I think that that's the creative risk of friendship is actually the kind of building blocks also for a peaceful world, a smarter world, a wiser world. And I would say this, the second creative risk that not a lot of people are taking right now is to take time to read novels. That is the other way that I have come to have wisdom. And it actually feels like risk-taking right now because we're in a quarantine. I've got to over output my work to show that I'm worthy of still having a job. And the last thing I want to do is sit down and read a novel that's not directly related to the journalism I'm doing because that feels like a risk of time. But when you read a novel, when you engage in your daily life, instead of feeling like an animal almost and reactionary to everything that's happening, you start to see people more clearly. And from an objective end, it's like, oh, that person is doing this, but they also have this. You see people in 3D versus 2D. And you see people are a mixed bag. You see how complicated cause and effect is. You see how things are chemistry. You also can see yourself. You can narrate how you're walking down the street. It's just a different level of self-awareness. And it's kind of, it's a religion, I feel like, in itself, or a way of life.
Oh, 100%. And I'm sure you find, and I feel like you're kind of saying this, that when you do take that creative risk of like going into other worlds, and for me, it might be reading. It's also this work that I'm trying to do to make these songs and these stories for this show and go in new directions that I haven't been in before, that those explorations end up feeding back into the other parts of your life that you thought they weren't necessarily instrumental to. All the work you're worried about procrastinating on because you're reading a novel, those journeys actually end up feeding that other stuff in very useful ways, even though you're not approaching it from a utilitarian perspective. You know,
the two series that I most recently did, Unerased and Dolly Parton's America.
Yes.
When they were written up, some of the comments about the series were focusing on the empathic journalism. Like, oh, it's a new form of empathic journalism. Or it's like, I'm not saying it was creating that, but I was either comparing it to other forms of that or just kind of reveling in, this is not quite what you normally hear.
I've never heard that term, but you know, for sure, This American Life and other things could fall under that umbrella.
Yes. With Unerased, which is about conversion therapy in America, about young men being converted from gay to straight within the religious community. Before we did the interview with a man named John Smid, who was out of the closet, then back in the closet, then out of the closet, then back in the closet, and who converted young men to being straight, was ahead of the program. The day before we interviewed him for several hours on end, we had lunch with him and I shared about my own experiences in religion. It was a creative risk to take. Like, I was vulnerable. Like, this is what happened to me. This is what I experienced. This is how I understand what you, this, I don't say this is how I understand you, but I could understand how he did things that he knew weren't quite true, not meaning to. But once your entire community is your religious group, it is very difficult to act outside of the demands of the religious group. It becomes kind of self-obedience. But because I took that risk, which by this point, it's become such a muscle for me that it doesn't feel like a risk. When I was younger, I had to force it. I had to force to do that because I had good people around me that had done it for me, and it had healed my suffering and my trauma and my own pain through hearing the stories of others. So I made it a point to share mine, right? And but I also knew this man was ashamed about what had happened, what he had done. The next day in the interview, we went places that I don't think we knew we could go. Same thing with Dolly Parton's America. The Dollyologists are academics. Like, these are respectable women that are leading a PhD program, or they're professional writers, or maybe going to run for office one day. Shout out to Sarah Smarsh. I hope she becomes president one day. But these are women that are very articulate, intellectual. You know, they have to write logically and realistically and can make these brilliant connections. But the most moving parts of the series to me, and also the experience of making the series and some moments that you don't hear in the podcast, are when Helen Morales shares about very painful moments of shame in her life and what it is like to be a daughter of immigrants. And Sarah Smarsh shared about her divorce and about, you know, her unborn child in her book. These were things that we focused on based off our own pain. Lynn Sacco, who was the Dolly Parton's America professor, she did not want to give me her syllabus. And then she didn't want to even talk to me because the entire nation was like, all the schools across the nation were trying to get the syllabus so they could teach the Dolly course. And so, you know, she basically emailed me and she said, I'm not giving you my syllabus. Everyone wants this. Who the hell are you? So I found her thesis from USC where she talks about children that were sexually abused and the doctors that hid the abuse when they were treating the children in order to protect the parents who were paying their medical bills. And when I knew that that's what Lynn had focused on in her PhD, I knew like she was my kindred spirit. Like, she was thinking about the people who have the least amount of power in the society who have suffered the most. And so when we got on the phone, we shared so deeply. I shared so many stories about my life. She shared so many stories about her life. After that, she was like a golden vessel of ideas for the series. And she let us meet her class.
So that begins with your taking, in a sense, the risk of investing the time and energy and thought or whatever that it took to read through her whole thesis, to give it that kind of attention.
And also the risk of, as a quote unquote journalist, being a human with other humans that you're interviewing, which is like,
right.
I feel like it should be natural, but maybe it's because I'm a strange one. But I think we put on our occupation hat and we have a certain reserve in a room. And to me, that's not the most interesting audio.
It is really interesting to think about whatever the shift in the culture, in humanity, whatever it might be, that has brought us from that older model of a rigid kind of idea of objectivity in journalism to this place where what they were calling empathic journalism is what people want to make. I agree with you. It's more interesting. These are the stories and the conversations that you naturally want to hear.
The risk of being honest, that actually opens up new worlds in history and life. Like, it's really hard, right? Like, I know you a little bit more now, so you know things about me that I will never say on this podcast. And that's a risk we take to actually connect to people, which connection is so intrinsically connected to happiness. And think about a world where people are honest and taking the risk to actually connect. Think about the kind of art and creativity that comes from that kind of person, that kind of community, that kind of world. You know, like Art Blakey would say, you know, the famous jazz musician, you can't hide behind your instrument. Who you are comes out of everything you do. And I think that's, I think that's human revolution, human rallying, you know, that's kind of what I hope to do in like every encounter, like creative risk, you know, open when you don't want to open, connect when you don't want to connect. Also sometimes to read when you feel like you should be doing other things, and open yourself up to things that scare you, which you need to rally for. Like, I'm so scared right now. I feel a lot of fear, but I also was strangely, I stayed up really late last night thinking about this, but I feel a lot of fear right now. I have moments where I realize, oh, this is going to be a tough moment for everyone. And it is already a tough moment for myself. We don't know what the future has for the country or for the world, but I felt so much appreciation because I was facing that. My insides were rallying and I had flashbacks of all these other times that I'd faced horrific obstacles and such devastating heartbreak and such injustice and being thrown under the bus, being blamed for something that wasn't true, like being used to discredit another person. Like, we all go through many things in our lives. And I, at those times when I was younger, I rallied, but it was so hard. And I was so happy that in my life right now, while I am facing such an obstacle, my inner life was so clear. I am a pillar that cannot be taken down. If we're on the Titanic, this ship isn't sinking. I'm Molly Brown. I'm unsinkable, you know? That's it, you know? You know, in full circle, when Dolly Parton's first film, 9 to 5, came out, that week she was on the cover of Rolling Stone. I think the 40-year anniversary was while the podcast was coming out. And on the front cover of Rolling Stone, it said, "The unsinkable Dolly Parton." And I knew that's from the Titanic, but that was something I'd always clung to. I really hope, like, we can all be unsinkable, you know, in our own way.
That sense of unsinkability comes over time from sinking and rising.
Many
and
trials.
Sinking and rising again in so many
rally again ways. And again and again. You know how they say if you're knocked down 8 times, get up that 9th? But I think that is an incredible human being. Think about the person you want to call when you're going through something. It's that person. And if there are no people like that on the planet, it is a very scary place. We're all walking up the mountain, like kind of grabbing the person below us, like, don't worry, I got up here. You can get up here too. I think being alone, even a strong person falls down an uneven path. But if you are connected, creatively risking, to be honest, and have true friendship, very dangerous. You will make it out okay.
Sometimes you find it in yourself. Sometimes you find it in others. So as long as that network of connection is there, it's always available to you.
Yeah. This is kind of intense. Jason?
Hopefully it'll be a slightly less claustrophobic world when this episode comes out. But I think this wisdom is useful at all times because we're always facing these kinds of obstacles. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jason. You rock.
No, you rock. Thanks, Yuma.
Hey, thanks for listening. It's lonely out here. I'd love to hear from you. You can send me an email through my website, jasongotz.com. I'd love to hear anything you're thinking about the show, you know, any reactions, any thoughts at all. And please tune in 2 weeks from now for episode 4, Lace, with consciousness expanding therapist Françoise Borzat. And if you're a beginning meditator or an experienced one or someone who's never meditated before, please feel free to stick around after this for a bonus guided meditation. So, settling into a comfortable posture. If you're walking, notice any rigidity in your gait or stance. Try to be loose yet upright. If you're sitting, drop your chin to your chest. Feel a lengthening in the spine and then kind of let the head float back up to center. Feel the body, shoulders kind of hanging loosely off the spine. A lightness and energy that's upright but not too stiff. Check in with where you're at right now. What's going on inside your body, inside your mind? Try to open yourself to the whole field of internal sensation. Everything that's happening inside, that includes thoughts, the awareness of my voice, any tightness in the muscles, any pain that might be anywhere, sensations of warmth or pleasure, places where you feel loose and relaxed. Just notice what's going on. Notice the way that the world inside us and outside us is constantly buzzing with signals and invitations into doorways, places to investigate, or if we're not paying attention, to get lost and caught up, swept away. Sit with stillness and equanimity in the center of this maelstrom. Observe it with clarity and calm. Check in with your breath. Notice if, at the suggestion to check in with your breath, the body tenses up or the breath becomes a different thing from what it was. Notice that. There's nothing wrong with that. Nothing to judge in that tendency, just as there's nothing to judge in the tendency of our minds to get swept off down different rabbit holes, sluices, tributaries. That's what the mind does. This is how the body reacts to thoughts. This is what we do. But noticing that, noticing if your breath has, you know, suddenly self-regulated in a different way or started performing breath. And then leave it alone. Leave your breath alone. Watch it with a friendly curiosity, as something that is in you, but not of you. Or maybe better said, there's no you anywhere here. Not the body that holds the breath, not the breath itself, not the observer observing the breath. There is only breath and body and awareness. With that awareness, feel the breath. Focusing attention on the deep belly. Notice any subtle sensations as the breath comes in or goes out. Check in with the chest. Notice the sensations as the chest rises and falls, or if the breath is subtle and fine. Notice the lack of sensation. Sometimes after a period of observation, the breath will become so fine, so rarefied that, you know, sometimes the texts refer to it as like silk, fine cloth, barely perceptible. Sometimes it's rushing like a mighty river. Neither is correct or wrong. But notice what's going on. Anchored in the breath, can open our attention more widely to the sounds outside. Sounds around you in your immediate environment. The ambient sound of the room. Again, there's no you hearing. There is sound. There's sensation of sound in the ears, and there is awareness. Be aware of the sounds with equanimity and clarity and calm. If sensations have appeared in the body in the meantime, it's fine to check in with them. If suddenly there's tension in the back or an ache somewhere, it's okay to shift the attention to there. Notice the bare sensation as it enters consciousness before it turns into a story. Try to rest in that place of bare awareness. Holding space for that sensation for as long as it remains. Not rushing to shift position. Not rushing to escape from it. Not rushing to judgment about it. Just observe the sensation. When you're ready, and gently open the eyes. Take in the bare awareness of the visual surroundings before sight turns into naming, turns into stories. And as you go throughout your day, when you remember, when it comes back to you, rest in the same bare awareness for a moment here, a moment there, making a little space for yourself between sensation and thought.